Good afternoon. My name is David Ogunsetan. For those who are visiting us for the first time, welcome to our public health seminar series. Typically, we meet over at the McDonnell Douglas Auditorium. So I was standing out there, making sure those who are lost will see me and come here. But this is such a nice space that we wish we could use it every time. But it's expensive, and we will use it for very special guests, such as the one we have today. And actually, his background and training and expertise fits very well with the CALITI2 program. This was, for those who don't know what CALITI2 stands for, California Institute for Telecommunications, and there's another T involved there. But this was legislature-sponsored initiative approved by the people of California to build the world-class telecommunications program in the age of the internet. And many universities competed for that program, and UC Irvine and UC San Diego collaborate. And this building was made possible by the funds that the people of California put to that effort. It has allowed the university to build all kinds of expertise. They sponsor undergraduate programs, graduate research opportunities that are interdisciplinary. I think somewhere upstairs there is a hyper wall where large-scale modeling occurs. So they model things like global climate change and infectious diseases. A lot of work that CALITI2 sponsors is pertinent to health. So today's speaker, many of our faculty members, through their network, identify to us people who work in areas of interest, cutting edge in their field, and of relevance to faculty across our campus. Today's speaker was nominated by Professor Suzanne Huang. She couldn't be here with us today, otherwise she would be standing here introducing Dr. Bruce Lee. And it's really a pleasure for me to stand in Suzanne's place to do this honor. Dr. Lee is currently an Associate Professor of Medicine and Biomedical Informatics at the University of Pittsburgh, and he's a core faculty of the RAND University of Pittsburgh Health Institute. I asked him how his flight was, and he said he just came down from Seattle because he has a long-term interaction with the Gates Foundation there. So he's all over the country in collaborations and establishing programs that are of interest, as he did with the Public Health and Infectious Diseases Computational and Operations Research called FICOR group at the University of Pittsburgh. And this is a very, very interdisciplinary group. They design economic and operational computer models that help decision makers tackle infectious diseases of global importance. He is the scientific lead for the HAMES project and the RARE project, and his current funding comes from Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the NIH, CDC, National Science Foundation, and the National Library of Medicine. He's a very prolific researcher. He got his bachelor's at Harvard and also his MD at Harvard. And then he added the master's in business administration from Stanford Graduate School of Business. This is essentially, he embodies the kind of interdisciplinary work that we hope will lead to solutions to all the global health problems that we teach in classes and we try to do research on. So please join me to welcome Dr. Bruce Lee to UC Irvine.
Thank you, Dilly, for inviting me, and thank you, all of you, for attending the seminar. So I want to try to make this as interactive as possible, so I encourage questions throughout the talk. I'm happy to take the talk through different directions, or if you want to ask questions or have a discussion at the end, that's fine as well. So I'll be talking about virtual global health, computational modeling and simulation. So how modeling and simulation can be applied to different types of global health questions and decisions. And when I say global health, that also includes domestic issues as well. So I'm going to run through a quick what is modeling, and then look at how modeling may be applied to different areas of global health, such as vaccine development, vaccine delivery, vaccine administration, and other areas besides vaccines, because there are interventions besides vaccines. And then we can save the last part for a summary or discussion, and we can go back to any of the issues or questions that may be lingering after going through these. So the first question is, what is modeling? So when I tell people that I'm a modeler, they look at my clothing and my general choice of clothing, and they say, I'm not so sure about that. So when I'm talking about modeling, I'm not talking about this type of modeling. I'm talking about more about computer modeling and using computers and mathematical equations to represent different questions and issues. So essentially, modeling and simulation is taking any type of situation, process, system, or decision and creating a mathematical or computer representation of that. So I ask people, so when is the last time you modeled? So maybe Diane, we can ask you, when is the last time you modeled? And not the previous type of modeling, but...
I'm looking at your decolonization models, but I personally have not done any of that.
Okay. What about yourself over there? When's the last time you modeled?
Friday.
This past Friday?
Yeah.
Okay.
I do some time series modeling and forecasting of kind of seasonal components of mental disorder.
Okay, sounds good. What about yourself? When's the last time you modeled? Yep.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Maybe a year ago.
A year ago, okay. Can you give me an approximate month?
April,
okay. So all of you are wrong. So in fact, you just modeled right here and now. So when you considered my question and you considered different possible answers, you were actually modeling that in your head. So you sat there and said, okay, he's asking me a question. Should I look away? Should I try to ignore it? Okay, maybe he's still looking at me, so I need to do something about this. So what are my different possibilities? You know, I can continue to be silent, I can answer. So then you looked at that outcome. So you said, if I continue to be silent, well, maybe he'll go away. But what's the probability of that? Because, you know, this is being filmed, et cetera. And you said, okay, how should I answer? Well, you answered April, I think, or last year. And then you answered on Friday. And then you in your mind, you basically modeled the different possibilities. If I answer Friday, what might happen? And so forth. So in essence, we're modeling constantly. So every single decision, every type of action, it's a result or a summary of many micro models that are running in your head. I mean, you basically, many times you do things by instinct, but in essence, that's a collection of models that's constantly going on in your head and making these decisions. So modeling is essentially, everyone models every day. So modeling is essentially taking that process that's going on in people's heads and putting it on a table so that everyone can see either a table or a computer or on a set of papers with mathematical equations so that we can see not only what other people are thinking or how other people are representing a system, but how you yourself are representing a system or a decision. Because many times you make decisions throughout the day and you don't really think about it. You don't realize what inputs and what measures and what intermediate relationships go into that making that decision. So when you actually try to construct a model to try to determine what your thinking process is doing, many times it can be surprising. Many times you make a decision based on faulty information or relationships that you think are present but may not be present, or maybe you're missing major relationships that should impact the decision that you're making. So computer simulation modeling is widely used in many different areas. So air and space travel and exploration is one example. So they won't send up a rocket or a space shuttle until hours and hours or days of modeling and simulation are performed. Transportation, natural resource and energy exploration. This has become a bad example over the past several years, but finance and investment. Military and defense, and sports as well. So sports is actually one of the newer areas where modeling and simulation is used. So, for instance, the New England Patriots use models, computer models and simulations to, to better understand or anticipate what opposing defenses and offenses might put together for the next game. The Houston Rockets use modeling and simulation to help determine the appropriate draft picks. So by comparison, medicine and public health have actually lagged many other fields in terms of using modeling simulation. Now, we're trying to change that over the past decade. But previously, there had been more of a disconnect between these potentially powerful methodologies and public health and medicine. Now, that's changing. And in many ways, public health is ideal for modeling simulation because, first of all, it uses a number of different factors that go into decision-making in public health. It crosses disciplines. Decision-making and the results can be very complex. So you can make a decision and can have percolating effects that you don't anticipate. And, of course, the outcomes are extremely important. So you can't afford to make mistakes in public health. Say you unleash a program in a particular area that takes a lot of time, effort, consumes a lot of resources, and many times the results aren't seen until several years after the decision has been made, and sometimes too late to change that decision. So I want to emphasize that modeling is not a replacement for other types of methodologies. It can serve as a complement. So you have retrospective studies, prospective studies. You don't necessarily create a model or a simulation to replace or in place of a prospective or retrospective study, but you can help. Modeling can help guide the design of these types of studies and also help complement these studies so that you can overcome some of these limitations. So we all know that retrospective studies can be very powerful, same with prospective studies, but they do have some limitations such as data availability. And let's see how we work this one. Okay, here we go. Such as data availability, so you may not have the right data available to answer the question. Generalizability, so say you collect data in a certain location, so say you collect the data in Thailand, is that applicable to Africa or the US or even other parts of Thailand or other parts of Southeast Asia? And granularity, many times the data that you have doesn't go down to the level that you're actually interested in, so you might have data that's collected for an entire country, but you may not know. You may not have data for specific towns or specific cities. Similarly, prospective studies. You have same issues with generalizability. Study populations, so say you conduct a prospective study on for a particular population. Does it apply to other populations? Or does it even apply to that population after several years because populations change over time? It can be very expensive, and there can be ethical and legal issues. So say you want to study the transmission of a certain virus in a location. Well, if you wrote a study where you're going to release that virus and see what happens, that most likely is not going to pass any IRB. So modeling can serve as this bridge amongst these different methodologies. So it can help translate an idea or need into designing a retrospective study or a prospective study. It can serve as a bridge between these two, and it can also serve a bridge between translating the results of these studies to different policies and practices. So one use of modeling simulation is to identify priorities in terms of studies and data collection. So if you create a model in simulation to determine what might be different, if you know the value of a certain parameter or a certain type of data much better, and it can show you the value of that information. So let's go through some examples of modeling and simulation being used for vaccine development, for instance. So this, I just wanted to point out, this is the FICOR team. The coordinator is Sarah Barsh. Chris Bacon coordinates our neglected tropical diseases modeling efforts. And a number of these other members I'll point out because there's a lot of other teams that we work with or that are involved in our modeling efforts. So for the development of different interventions such as vaccines, we often merge economic and operational modeling with epidemiological modeling. So for instance, we can help try to determine the burden landscape and do segmentation analyses to help characterize a problem and help target interventions and intervention development. I'll give you an example the next slide of that. We can also assess different types of interventions, such as the cost-benefit, cost-effectiveness, budget impact, and return on investment. If you, for instance, want to determine where should you invest funds to develop an intervention. So it can help prioritize investment, prioritize development, and prioritize data collection. As I mentioned, it can help direct, you know, where are the high-impact areas to direct data collection. It can guide the development, investment, and implementation of these interventions. It can help establish target profiles for different interventions. How many of you are familiar with target product profiles? Have you heard of the term? So TPPs, which is short for target profiles, essentially are menus or wish lists for an intervention or a measure. So say you want to develop some type of vaccine. So for a certain type of, to prevent a certain type of disease. What should be the efficacy, target efficacy for that vaccine? What should be the target population? What should be the duration of action? There's all these different parameters that you need, that ideally you want to establish before you actually develop the intervention. So for instance, this is an example of a study that we published in Lancet Infectious Diseases where we looked at the economic burden of Chagas disease. And Chagas disease, as you may know, is a disease that affects Latin America quite substantially. And essentially, it can lead to, ultimately, the parasite is transmitted by insect vector, and then it can ultimately lead to all types of cardiac complications. So it can lead to cardiomyopathy or congestive heart failure. But it hasn't been well characterized in terms of its impact, its global impact. So in this study, we essentially profiled what are the potential healthcare costs, what are the DALYs, DALY stands for Disability Adjusted Life Years effect, and what are the productivity effects of Chagas disease. And we looked at different countries and different regions, Latin America, North America, Europe, Australia, and total. So we essentially built a simulation model where if a single person got infected with Trypanosoma cruzi, which is the parasite that causes Chagas disease, then what would happen to that person? So we created this outcomes model where we would feed infected individuals into this model, and then they would progress as simulated patients would progress. So many of them would remain asymptomatic for a number of different years, and then eventually progress either to mild heart disease or major heart disease, or some would not survive. So essentially, it's a simulation model of what would happen. So we sent thousands or millions of infected individuals through this just to basically simulate patients in Latin America, North America, Europe, and all these different regions. And then we generated costs. So for instance, if a simulated patient had to go to the emergency room or go to the hospital to get treatment, then that would be associated with certain costs. So if a simulated patient had to get an echocardiogram, then we would attach that cost, the cost of our echocardiogram, to that. And we generate each of these different results. So the main punchline with this is that the overall cost and overall burden is quite substantial globally. And then also we found that healthcare costs were one component, productivity losses also contribute substantially. So many of these individuals who develop Chagas disease, essentially it's a chronic disease, so they have chronic heart failure, and over a number of years, their productivity or their ability to contribute to the workforce steadily declines. And that is a tremendous burden on the locations or the countries where this is happening. And we also found that the burden in North America is not insignificant. So we have a reasonable burden in North America as well as Europe. And this is traditionally thought of more as a Latin American disease. So all these findings suggest that, number one, that this is a substantial health problem, and it's comparable to many cancers and many diarrheal diseases that get much more attention. And it's also a problem that's not necessarily regional. It's affecting other parts of the world, and it's growing as well. And then the final take-home point was that these substantial productivity losses should be noteworthy to businesses because they're essentially affecting the economy. So there's many situations where You have these diseases that are affecting the healthcare system, but they're also affecting the general economy, which ultimately may motivate businesses to pay more attention to this. An example of this occurring was HIV. So HIV, is, as you know, causes substantial burden throughout the world, but it wasn't until it was demonstrated that it actually causes productivity losses that many businesses were willing to start supporting drug regimen or treatment for people who are infected with HIV. Because ultimately, businesses realize once something's affecting their bottom line, that it may be a worthwhile investment to start trying to prevent or control the problem.
I assume you use different costs for different regions for this line, because
yes.
The U.S. number is very small compared to...
Yes. So what we did, excellent question. So for each country, we pull the different income numbers, we pull the healthcare costs, we also change the type of regimens or treatments that they receive based on the specific country or specific region. Okay. So then once you outline the burden and try to segment what the burden is like, and by segment I mean identify which regions or which sectors are bearing different proportions of the burden, one of the next steps might be to start developing a plan or a menu for an intervention for that disease. So this is an example of visceral leishmaniasis, which is a substantial problem in different parts of the world, in particular India. And currently, there are some interventions out there, such as treatment and some general environmental interventions, but there's no vaccine. So we wanted to determine, if we were to develop a vaccine for visceral leishmaniasis, what should it look like? And there are currently several candidates under development. So we wanted to not only guide future development of technologies, but also guide the current development of leishmaniasis vaccine. So similar to Chagas disease, we developed a disease model, a simulation model, in which individuals could cycle through these different states. So an individual could either get a vaccine or no vaccine, and then that individual would remain well but susceptible to infection for a number of years, and at some point that person might get infected and travel through these different states. I won't go through these in detail, but after talk, be happy to go back and walk through the model in greater detail. But essentially, we send patients through this model and have them get vaccinated and have them did not, and then measure the different outcomes of what might happen. And then we determine the incremental cost effectiveness of vaccine for visceral leishmaniasis. And we range a number of different values, such as the vaccine cost or the vaccine efficacy. So each of these lines represent different vaccines of different efficacy. This horizontal line is the vaccine cost, or cost of vaccination, and this is the incremental cost effectiveness ratio. Now, are any of you familiar with ICERs, or incremental cost effectiveness ratios?
Some.
Okay, so I can quickly summarize. So essentially, it is the difference in the numerator is the difference in cost between two different situations. So you might have the difference in cost between having a vaccine versus not having a vaccine, and the denominator is the difference in health effects. So, and in this case, we're measuring health effects in terms of DALYs, disability-adjusted life years. So disability-adjusted life years, taking into account not only the years of life lost, but also the years lost to disability. So for instance, if you are, if you're not functioning 100%, so if you're either disabled, you're not feeling as well, you're not going to be as productive. Your life is not going to be as productive as if you were in perfect health. So what we did was essentially measure the difference in cost between people who received the vaccine and people who did not receive the vaccine, and a difference in DALYs between people who received the vaccine and did not receive the vaccine. And then by WHO, or World Health Organization criteria, if the ICER is less than 3 times the GDP per capita for that country, then the intervention is considered cost effective. And if it's less than 1 times the GDP per capita for that country, it's considered highly cost effective. So these are different thresholds for something being considered cost-effective and highly cost-effective. Is that clear to everyone? I'd be happy to go through examples if needed. But so essentially what we did was we measured the ICER for different scenarios or different vaccination costs, different vaccine efficacy, and we ranged the variables of all different vaccine parameters such as duration of action, number of doses. And we found that there are many situations in which the vaccine was cost effective and in many cases highly cost effective. So here you can see that as long as it remains below this dotted line, it's highly cost effective. And below this dashed line, it's cost-effective. Not surprisingly, the vaccine efficacy had a substantial impact on the cost-effectiveness of the vaccine, but we still were able to find situations where even a 25% efficacious vaccine is cost-effective or even highly cost-effective. So that's just the vaccine doesn't necessarily have to be perfect to be valuable. So we also did something similar to develop a model for the Chagas disease vaccine. And again, these are the details. This is the schematic for the model. Essentially, people would walk through these different states, and these are different probability nodes. Again, I'd be happy to go through this in detail after the talk. And we found with the Chagas disease vaccine that the vaccination is cost-effective when it costs up to $200, as long as its efficacy is greater than 75%. And if the vaccine efficacy is greater than 75% and vaccine cost was $20, vaccination saved costs as well as provided health benefits. Now, when that occurs, that's considered an economically dominant intervention. In other words, it's a no-brainer to use it. It not only saves costs, but also provides health benefits. Most interventions, you have to pay something to gain the health benefits. And we're essentially trying to say, okay, we want to minimize that cost. And if it goes below a certain threshold, then the intervention is considered cost effective. But there are some situations where an intervention not only provides health benefits, but also provides cost savings. So it's making you money as well as providing health benefits. And that's a slam dunk. That's a perfect situation because there's no net outlay of cost. We're actually gaining money. So we found that with the Chagas disease vaccine, there are many situations where it can actually provide cost savings along with health benefits. And we outline those different scenarios. Basically, the vaccine has to be this efficacious, above this efficacy threshold. It has to be below this cost. And we use this to provide or outline the target profile for different groups who are currently developing the Chagas disease vaccine. So I want to acknowledge some of my collaborators, some key collaborators with this work with the Neglected Tropical Disease Vaccine Development. Peter Hotez, who's a dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine, Maria Botazzi, Dave Diemert, and Jeff Bethany. They've been invaluable with this work. So I wanted to move on to the next category, which is the delivery of medical goods. In this case, we're using as an example vaccine delivery. So vaccines, of course, have been one of the biggest successes in public and global health. Vaccines have had tremendous impact on reducing the risk of disease and reducing the morbidity and mortality of disease. But one of the key components of vaccines or any type of medical intervention is they actually have to reach the population to be effective. So our Hermes team, Hermes logistics team, has focused on building models to help understand the distribution and delivery of different medical goods, in particular vaccines, but we've also moved to other types of medical goods. And this is our team. It's a multidisciplinary team, which includes people from different backgrounds and different areas of expertise. So our co-coordinators are Dan O'Connor and Angela Wateska. We have experts in supply chain management, and industrial engineering. So Brian Norman and Jay Roskopol have worked with a number of different companies of different industries, such as Dick's Sporting Goods, UPS, Walmart, and Target. And they've brought their expertise over the past 4 years to our team to help understand how a lot of the learnings from other industries might translate to vaccine distribution and medical good distribution. Sean Brown is our technical lead. He's the Director of Public Health Applications at the Pittsburgh Supercomputing Center, and he has a background in computational sciences. Joel Welling is our lead developer. He was the first employee of the Pittsburgh Supercomputing Center. Yuting Wang is also a developer, as well as Jim Leonard. Aaron Claypool is an industrial engineer, and then we've got many experts in public health modeling, such as Leila Hadari, Diana, and Angela, as I mentioned previously. So I want to emphasize that this is a true team effort, that we have many diverse individuals who are contributing to this work. So through our efforts, we've developed a software platform called Hermes, which stands for Highly Extensible Resource for Modeling Supply Chains. The vision of Hermes is to create a freely available and user-friendly software tool for different types of decision makers, whether they're manufacturers, intervention developers, policy makers, or funders, to generate an interactive simulation model of any supply chain, which can serve as a virtual laboratory to help answer a number of different questions. Are all of you familiar with what a supply chain is? No? So a supply chain is the series of steps and processes and components and resources that it takes to get some type of good from one location to another. So for instance, if I want to get vaccines from the manufacturers to different countries, and within the countries from the central locations in that country to the population, it has to go through a series of steps. So it has to go through a complex network of vehicles, personnel, storage locations, and other types of locations to eventually get to the people. So it's actually a quite complex effort that needs to be orchestrated and coordinated. So we use Hermes to develop detailed simulation models of all these steps and processes to answer questions such as, what's the impact of introducing new technologies, such as new vaccines, new storage devices, new monitoring devices? What happens if you change the characteristics of all these different technologies? What if you change the configuration operations of the supply chain? For instance, if you remove or add locations, change the configuration, or change the number of levels that the supply chain has? What's the effects of different conditions and circumstances, such as power outages or shipping delays? Where should you best invest or allocate resources? And how to optimize vaccine delivery? So Hermes creates these discrete event simulation models, which are essentially these virtual representations. So if you think SimEarth or SimCity or Second Life or some of those computer programs, this is essentially Sim supply chain. So we represent each of the refrigerators, freezers, personnel, vehicles, and storage facilities in great detail, virtual representations of these things. So just like the real versions of them, they all have different characteristics, such as a make and model, a capacity, energy consumption, unit costs, and each of the different vaccine vials is represented by computational entities. So we have millions of these virtual vaccine vials flowing through the system, and each vaccine vial has an antigen type, has a package size, temperature profile, things like that. The service delivery locations are represented similarly, but they have some key differences. One is you have healthcare workers there who perform things such as open the vaccine vials, reconstitute the vaccines, and then administer it to arriving clients. So these arriving clients are essentially children or mothers who are scheduled to receive the vaccines. So they arrive just like virtual people. And if the vaccine is available and the healthcare worker is available, then they're successively immunized. If they're not available, then they are counted as missed immunization opportunities. And then all these things that are used or consumed go to medical waste, and all the vaccine doses that are not used go to open vial wastes. So we run these simulations, and we can pull any type of information from these simulations after they're run, just like a virtual laboratory. And we can test different types of scenarios. So we've worked in a number of different countries. So we've developed models of the supply chains in Senegal, and this is not listed here, but oh, here it is, Benin, Niger. We're working on India, forgot the name there. We've developed models of Vietnam and Thailand. In particular, I want to point out that we've worked with a number of different collaborators. For the Vietnam and Senegal model, we've worked with Project Optimize, which is also funded out of the Gates Foundation, and they consist of the World Health Organization and PATH. And for this Benin model, we've worked closely with AMP, which is based in Paris, as well as WHO. We've worked with UNICEF for a number of these different projects, and we're currently developing a model of two states in India, Bihar and Kerala, and we're working closely with UNICEF, the Public Health Foundation of India in there, as well as INCLINS. So a number of different collaborators that I want to emphasize. And through part of this effort, we've been developing the EVM plus Hermes initiative, which is funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. The EVM is an effective vaccine management tool that's been developed by the World Health Organization. It's oriented towards quality assessment, so it evaluates the current vaccine management practices, comparing against best practice scenarios. And then our Hermes tool is, as I mentioned, can explore operations, simulate additions, and help optimize the operations and structures of the supply chain. So we're combining these along with other tools to create a suite of tools that any country or organization can use to evaluate, diagnose, and help improve a vaccine supply chain. So our initial test country was Benin, and our second pilot country is India for this. And I wanted to quickly run through some examples of studies that we've done. Each of these studies originated from decision-maker questions, many times in country. So, for instance, the Niger Ministry of Health was interested in determining what's the impact of introducing pneumococcal rotavirus vaccines into their routine WHO-EPI immunization program. And we essentially found that if you introduce these new vaccines, it substantially exacerbates existing bottlenecks within the supply chain. So there are currently transport and storage bottlenecks throughout the Niger supply chain. These are overcome in part through coping. So many of the locations and personnel there will try to do things to cope to get the vaccines to the people. So they'll use less standard measures to actually get the vaccines to their locations. But once you introduce these new vaccines, the coping gets overwhelmed, and you essentially substantially exacerbate these bottlenecks so that all the vaccines, and not just the pneumococcal and rotavirus vaccines, can't get to the population. And this is highly dependent on the size of the vaccine. So if you introduce much larger presentations of these vaccines, the bottlenecks get a lot worse. So we also done studies such as looking at the impact of changing the presentation of different vaccines. So the Thai Ministry of Health was interested in switching the 10-dose measles vaccine with a single-dose presentation, actually a single-dose MMR. So we simulated that change, and we found that the Thai supply chain actually has considerable capacity to accommodate this change, and that this change can actually benefit Thailand by reducing the amount of open vial wastage that occurs. By open vial wastage, I mean the number of doses that are not used. Similarly, the Thai Ministry of Health was interested in introducing the flu vaccine through their standard routine supply chain and wanted to determine the effects of that. And we found that the impact of introducing the flu vaccine is highly dependent on what percentage of the population gets the flu vaccine, so if you want to vaccinate everyone versus certain high-risk groups, and how quickly you want to vaccinate everyone. So we found if you want to try to target the entire population and you want to try to vaccinate everyone within 1 or 2 months, the supply chain actually gets overwhelmed. So there are certain transport levels that don't have enough capacity to handle this rapid introduction of the flu vaccine. Now, if you space it out over a number of months, and if you reduce the target population to high-risk individuals, then the supply chain can handle it. So essentially, the decision has to be made of whether you want to limit who gets the flu vaccine or whether you want to augment the supply chain so that you can target the entire population. We've also looked at the impact of making different types of vaccines thermostable, and this is of great interest to a number of different funders as well as a number of different vaccine developers. And essentially, we looked at the Niger vaccine supply chain and what happens if you make different vaccines, such as pentavalent or measles vaccine, thermostable, so that you can actually pull it out of the cold chain, leave these vaccines outside of refrigerators and freezers for different periods of time, so you can potentially alleviate the burden that's on refrigeration and freezers. So we found that this can actually help reduce these bottlenecks that exist in countries such as Niger. And we've also looked at the impact of doing things such as adding storage or adding transport vehicles to different types of supply chains. We found that one has to be careful about adding storage devices such as refrigerators and freezers. For instance, if you were to add refrigerators and freezers to the Niger supply chain, you actually can worsen transport bottlenecks because you are creating more storage, but if you don't improve the transport at the same time, you can actually have the transport get clogged up because you have enough refrigerator space to hold these vaccines, but you don't have enough transport vehicles to take these vaccines down to the next level. And this is important because many times, historically, the solution has been to just send more refrigerators or freezers to a country if the thought is that there's not enough capacity to in the supply chain. But we want to emphasize that the supply chain is actually a dynamic, complex system. And we found many historical examples of these refrigerators and freezers being sent to these countries, and essentially they sit in warehouses or they're not used. So one of the benefits of doing modeling prior to making decisions such as those is you can actually determine, well, what's the optimal solution and how do we actually solve the vaccine distribution problems. So that's vaccine delivery. So now I wanted to move on to an example of vaccine administration. So for vaccine administration, this is an example of a study that was published in Health Affairs, where we essentially used a domestic model. So this is a model of the D.C. metropolitan region. So this includes a number of different counties in Washington, D.C., Maryland, Northern Virginia. And we created this virtual representation of the D.C. metro area. So we took U.S. Census data, and we created this agent-based model, which includes virtual representations of each person within the United States. And then we created virtual representations of all the different locations, such as households, employment locations, schools. And we assigned each of these agents to each of these locations. And then we created this virtual United States from which we can extract different subregions within the United States. So for instance, the DC metro region, or virtual Pennsylvania, or virtual California, what have you. And this, again, is similar to the SimCity or SimEarth, where we have these individuals throughout the day traveling between their households and schools and work locations or different community locations such as malls and interacting with each other. And we can simulate the spread of infectious diseases and the application of different types of interventions. So in this study, we asked the question, if you have a limited number of vaccines, so say flu vaccines during an epidemic, who should get those vaccines first? And this arose from our work in 2009 during the H1N1 pandemic. So during the H1N1 pandemic, I myself and one of my colleagues, Sean Brown, were embedded in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Specifically, we were in the office of the ASPR, which stands for the Assistant Secretary of Public Health Preparedness and Response. I believe that's the acronym. And we were using computer modeling to help with the national response to the H1N1 pandemic. So they would ask us questions such as, what's the impact of vaccines being delivered in a certain schedule? What's the impact of using antivirals in different populations and different situations? What's the impact of closing schools? What's the impact of on the different healthcare facilities in terms of surge capacity? You know, are there enough ventilators? Is there enough room for patients? Should different influenza scenarios carry out in different ways? And one of the questions that emerged was, where should vaccines go to first? Because as you probably recall, during 2009, the vaccines, there were a limited number of vaccines early on. So the vaccines didn't come out until later in the fall of 2009. So we ran different types of experiments in which we compared a situation where no vaccines were available, and then a situation where the vaccines went to the lowest income counties and the highest income counties, or equally distributed. And we had different scenarios in which only 200,000 doses were available, 400,000 doses were available, or 700,000 doses were available. Our findings were that you actually have the greatest savings and the greatest benefits if you give the vaccines, deliver the vaccines to the lowest income counties first. And can anyone guess why that might be the case? Any thoughts behind that? I'm sorry?
Living and working in proximity.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah. So that's one of the key components. Lower income counties or locations tend to be more densely populated. So individuals, there's heavy mixing with among those individuals. Any other reason or thoughts? So another key component is that there's a lot of traveling that occurs between lower income locations and higher income locations. So many people have to travel great distances to go to work. So essentially, lower income locations can serve as generators or many times cauldrons of epidemics. So you have heavy mixing. You have a lot of people who are mixing quite heavily so they can transmit amongst each other. And then they also travel extensively so they can transmit the flu or any type of other types of infectious diseases to other parts of the region. The same is not true with higher income locations or higher income counties, which tend to be more sparsely populated and people don't travel as much. So we found that it's beneficial to society and as well as businesses and many other components of society to give the vaccines to lower income locations first. And it's actually maybe beneficial to higher income locations because essentially you're cutting down overall transmission. So this slide essentially shows what happens if you delay vaccination to the two poorest counties. So these are different types of delays. This is no delay. This is 10-day delay, 20 delay, and 30 delay. This is the number of new influenza cases over time. This is days on this horizontal axis. So you can see that if you delay vaccination to the two poorest countries, you have a substantial effect on the number of cases that occur. So you can actually impede the mitigation of the epidemic by delaying to the two lowest counties. We don't see as great an effect if you delay delivery of the vaccine to middle-income counties or higher-income counties. So the conclusions from this study was that people are highly interconnected in the system, not isolated islands. So many times, one of the issues in public health is that different segments within society believe that they're isolated islands, that what happens in another location or another population won't affect them. But this is, indeed, as many of you know, is not true. So there is substantial benefit to actually protecting all communities, in particular communities where there are higher risk for disease outcomes or disease transmission. So as I mentioned, poor communities are important. And this is an example seemingly selfless altruistic behavior can actually lead to selfish utilitarian benefits. So many times in public health, we try to argue that, well, it's good to do this intervention because this is for the good of society. This would be helpful. And whereas that may ring true with many people, many times people have utilitarian concerns. So they need to, you know, they're concerned about first protecting their interests. If we demonstrate situations where you can actually, it's actually beneficial to people's quote unquote selfish interests to have to implement a program or intervention that's beneficial to public health, this is sort of a win-win situation. So finally, I wanted to go through an example of a non-vaccine, some non-vaccine work that we've been doing, and that will be familiar to some of the folks in the audience. So this is our REA team. REA stands for Regional Healthcare Ecosystem Analyst, which is a software program which can rapidly generate models of health systems or a number of different healthcare facilities. This is our core team, although our core team has been growing. We have other individuals that are not on the slide, but I wanted to point out Tyler Avery, who's based in Harvard. She does a lot of the analytical work with the data to transfer the data into a format that can be readily used for modeling. Sarah Barsh has been very key. She's a research coordinator of my group, but she's been helping coordinate a lot of our activities. Diane Kim, who's over there at UC Irvine. My key collaborator, Susan Wong, who's also based here at UC Irvine. And I also wanted to point out Kim Wong, because he's been key in developing Rhea. But everyone within the team has contributed substantially to this effort. So this is an example of a study that emerged from this modeling effort. As I mentioned, we essentially developed a virtual Orange County. So we've taken all the facilities, all the inpatient facilities, the acute care facilities, which are roughly a little over 30, but I guess 30 or 33 facilities, and about 71 or so nursing homes, and this in Orange County. And we have these virtual representations. So again, Rhea can rapidly create a model of the healthcare facilities in any region, and it can serve as a virtual laboratory to better understand different types of the spread of different types of infectious diseases and their control measures. And so we have these virtual representation of each healthcare facility. So for instance, we might have a hospital that has multiple intensive care units and multiple general wards, and we have these virtual patients that go from the community and get admitted to each of these different facilities. They can go to an ICU or go to a general ward, and within each of these facilities, they can mix and interact with each other. And some of these individuals are positive for MRSA and can transmit MRSA to other individuals through this close contact. So we can basically simulate the spread of MRSA within a healthcare facility and also between healthcare facilities, because these individuals can move from hospital to hospital. So then we can also simulate the application of different types of interventions. So in this case, we simulate the implementation of surveillance and contact isolation. And by surveillance, we mean, say, someone enters a healthcare facility, whether a nursing home or a hospital, they get tested for MRSA, or methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. And if they're positive, then they get isolated. If they're negative, they're left to mix with other individuals within their ward or intensive care unit. And by isolate, I mean we don't put them in a bubble, but we essentially have these contact isolation precautions, where anyone who's going to interact with patients who put on gloves and a gown so that they don't take the pathogen or MRSA and then transmit it to another patient that they work with. Now, these interventions, such as the surveillance or testing, as well as the contact isolation, are not 100% effective. So there's a sensitivity and specificity, so you can have false negatives. So people who are colonized but are not isolated and remain actively infectious and can transmit the pathogen to other individuals. And we also have false positive, where people are isolated, but they really don't need to be isolated. And then the isolation procedures also have an efficacy and compliance. So it's not 100% efficacious. So if you use isolation procedures, there's still a chance of you transmitting MRSA. So this study, which was published in Health Affairs, looked at implementing these interventions, the surveillance and contact isolation, in different combinations of healthcare facilities. So, for instance, this table shows, and I actually believe that this table has, actually we can switch to this one. So this graph shows what happens if you implement this intervention in different healthcare facilities. So you start with the highest capacity hospital first. This is the 2 highest capacity hospitals, 3 highest, all the way to the 11 highest capacity hospitals. This y-axis is the countywide MRSA cases averted per year. And then each of these different lines are the interventions in different levels of compliance. So 25% compliance, 50% compliance, and 75% compliance. So there is a synergistic additive effect as you implement these interventions in more and more different hospitals. So what this previous table shows is comparing implementing this intervention in just this hospital alone versus the 5 highest capacity hospitals versus 10 highest capacity hospitals versus all hospitals. So we found the punchline behind this study is we found that there are synergistic effects. So for instance, if you yourself are a hospital and you implement these interventions, you can have a certain gains. You can reduce the number of cases that occur within your hospital. But there's a limit to that. That limit can actually be overcome if other hospitals are implementing this measure as well. So in other words, working together, you can have much greater gains than just working alone and not having cooperation. So we found, and there's actually situations where if you're not doing any type of intervention, but other hospitals are, you benefit as well. Because again, the hospitals are connected by patient sharing. So a patient gets discharged from another hospital, if that patient's MRSA positive and gets admitted to your hospital, you suffer the effects of that other hospital not controlling or preventing MRSA, and vice versa. So our general conclusions are that extensive patient sharing can spread MRSA among facilities, the MRSA control should account for this patient sharing, and that cooperation among facilities can attain synergies in MRSA control. And this is just an example of how RAIA can serve as a virtual laboratory for healthcare systems or healthcare facilities. And you know, we've used Orange County as the initial test county, but this can be applicable to other counties as well. And hopefully I've captured everything that we've talked about. You know, feel free to add anything that I've missed. But so in general, those are just some examples of some of the work that we've been doing in modeling and simulation. So in conclusion, modeling simulation can serve as this virtual laboratory to test interventions before they're applied, help shape interventions, or help answer a number of different questions that decision makers may have. And we've worked with a variety of different decision makers, ranging from funders to manufacturers to policymakers to ministries of health to other types of disease control officials. Widely used in many other industries, so my personal feeling is that the public health and medicine could substantially benefit from this work. It can save considerable time, effort, and resources, and it can serve as a complement, again, not as a replacement for other types of studies. So hopefully that's been useful, and I'd be happy to open up to questions and go back to any of these examples or provide more examples if useful as well. Thank you. Question over there?
Yes, I enjoyed the presentation. Mm-hmm. I think you kind of elegantly laid out the potential benefits of the modeling approach.
Thank you.
I want to think of, though, some forecasts where complexity isn't always better.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think the benefit is that when we see all these, I mean, we can kind of intuitively say the more information we have, the better we'll be able to kind of predict what's going to happen if we have this intervention.
Mm-hmm.
Small area population forecasting is one example where sometimes more complex models don't work out nearly as much because there's uncertainty about, say, migration rates.
Exactly.
And that annoys faculty because we get trained highly to be highly specialized and introduce more complexity that isn't always needed compared to like linear regression, you know, drawing a line between two dots.
Yes.
So my question is, given the simulations that you've run, have different constituents implemented it and then tested or examined essentially whether or not the precision that you use or the point estimates that you give adhere with what they find, either in terms of stimulating more research on the uncertainty or just kind of whether or not it actually got even close? Because, sounds great, but just wondering what the pragmatic evaluation has been.
So excellent question on multiple levels, because you actually pointed out certain key elements or key concepts that I'd like to emphasize. So one is that the issue of parsimony when modeling. So many times there's a tendency, as you mentioned, to make models overly complex. And we want to, instead, we want to try to model to the level of the question. So we want to try to, we don't want to make a model that's more complex than one that can answer the question. So for instance, if you have a situation where you are trying to decide, should I go to the store or not? So you usually make those decisions on, based on some limited factors. Okay, am I hungry? Do I have money? Is it 4 a.m. versus 10 p.m. or what have you? But you don't think about, well, what's happening in the other half of the world? Or, what is a certain Hollywood star doing? In theory, those things could affect your decision to go to the store. So if, for instance, I'm going to just toss out a name, Justin Bieber was doing something today that somehow trickled down to affect whether, you are going to be able to find something in the store, that's going to affect your decision. But you build a model, you're not going to include it there because it adds unnecessary complexity. Similarly with these models, we want to try to keep them as simple as possible, but we slowly add layer complexity when we realize that the simple model can't answer the question. So some of these models are fairly complex simply because they're addressing some complex issues, but you don't want to take some of these complex models and address something which can be answered by a more straightforward decision model or a compartment model or what have you. So we do all types of modeling, just giving some more complex examples. So that's the first point. So thank you for raising that. The second point is the point of validation or the issue of validation. So validation essentially is determining whether your model is representing what it's supposed to represent. And validation is not an either-or thing, or it's not binary. A model can never be fully validated. Instead, validation is assembling evidence or assembling an argument that your model is actually representing what it's supposed to represent. So, of course, the simplest or most basic validation is face validity. Does this model make sense? Does it seem like it's representing what it's supposed to represent? But then beyond that, we do different types of validation, and we're constantly doing validation. So we try to compare it with retrospective data. We try to determine if the model can reproduce what has already occurred or what is occurring or predict what may occur and then see if it actually compares. So I can give an example with our supply chain modeling. We've run workshops in places such as Senegal and Vietnam, and we've tried to simulate things that have already occurred and see if it yields the same results. Or we've had these situations where we were working with folks from the Ministry of Health or the EPI program and say, okay, what do you think would happen if we did this? If we, for instance, introduced new vaccines, which locations will have the greatest problems? Or what will happen to these refrigerators and freezers? And then they've made their predictions, and then we've run the models to see if it's compared. So we've done different types of validation or continuing validation. The validation I mentioned just now is more criterion validation, where you take a certain either gold standard or existing situation and see if the model can reproduce that. It's not always 100%, so there can be differences between what the model predicts and what actually happens, so we try to determine what's the differences. And if the difference is great enough, then we have to go back and say, well, maybe we're missing something. So each of these are in sort of in within that range. They tend to, we found that they tend to match up reasonably well. Not 100%, but reasonably well. And like you said, there are situations where we find we'll run the model and it has a certain amount of complexity, and we say, well, this is not necessary, and we'll peel that complexity away. So there's two reasons for putting something or some type of parameter or characteristic into a model. One is because we actually think it's going to have an effect, and two is to prove that it doesn't have an effect. So many times when people will see a model, they're like, oh, you aren't putting this into the model, or this isn't included, so we'll put that into the model just to show it doesn't really have an effect. But excellent question. Question?
I had a question. So mm-hmm. In your lecture, you were saying that implementing vaccines and treatments to low-income communities and also pricing vaccines seen through modeling can be better for the economy and public health and also well-being.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Can modeling be good to address public health issues ethically, but also mm-hmm. can it be used for, I guess, bad, like money making over human suffering.
Mm-hmm. So if I understand your question, I mean, to address one of your points, there are many situations where we can identify win-win situations in public health that people didn't really realize were win-win situations. So one example is many manufacturers have been reluctant to move into markets that have lower profit margins or no profit margins in some cases. But they found that there are situations where they can actually move into those markets and provide for those markets, and it can be beneficial for everyone. It's not as if we've interacted with many manufacturers, and in many cases, these companies will have many well-meaning people, but they have other constraints. They have other things that they have to work towards. So manufacturers have to keep an eye on their quarterly profits and their stock prices, et cetera. But you can develop a model to help identify a situation where they can that aspect can potentially benefit. So the profit and loss statement can benefit, and they're actually providing public health benefit as well. Now, I think your second question was, can models be used for more, devious reasons or et cetera? Certainly, any methodology can be used. A model, a study, any type of study methodology, clinical trials, retrospective studies, et cetera, they're all like, they can be weapons in the right, wrong hands, and they can be beneficials in the right hands. So the key is not to accept modeling as a general tool for everything. Similarly, you don't want to accept all clinical trials, and you don't want to use a clinical trial for every single question. But the key is to become a more discriminating evaluator or critic of modeling. In other words, if you understand how modeling can be applied and how it should be used and how it should not be used, then you can better determine, well, okay, this is an appropriate model, this is an inappropriate model, or this is a good situation where a model can be used, and vice versa. So I think that's important to keep in mind. We've run into situations where modeling is either universally accepted or universally rejected. So someone will see a model and they'll have a bad experience with it, so then they'll say, okay, I don't want to deal with models ever again. Or situations where they've had a good experience model, they're like, great, bring it on. Let's accept models of all kinds, et cetera. Either approach is wrong. So you essentially want to be able to understand what model, even if you're not a modeler, understand what it can do and how to assess and evaluate a model. Does that answer your question?
There will be more questions. You are invited to ask them at lunch over at ERB again. Thank you very much on behalf of our faculty and students. Just a little token.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Kat. So please join me.
Thank you.